Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I am one of your two hosts, Isaac Radansky, CEO and founder of Adventure Media Group, one of New York's hottest, fastest growing digital performance advertising agencies. And I am joined, as usual, by the great Patrick Gilbert, Adventure Media's very own director of operations and author extraordinaire of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, available in hardcover, in paperback, in Kindle, soon an audiobook on Amazon.com. And this podcast is only possible because of the hard work in production and editing and time management of our content queen, Danielle Immerman. So we're going to continue on last episode's journey to introspection and discovery and an analysis of high performance habits, because Patrick has been reading about high performance habits and he's been busting my chops about high performance habits. And in the last episode, we spoke about a few of them and where I think I fail. But I want to circle back, and I'm not going to let Patrick off the hook this time, because I asked Patrick where he struggles the most and he didn't answer us. And now we've held our breath, and I'm going to put the question to Patrick again to start off this episode. Patrick, where do you struggle the most?
Thanks for putting me on the spot. A great way to kick things off. I would say if anyone has not yet listened to the previous episode, please do so. I think none of this will make sense if you don't first listen to that other episode. This is regarding a book by Brendan Burchard. There are six key high performance habits that he outlines in his book. And as part of it, there's supplemental material on a website, highperformanceindicator.com, where you can take a quiz. It takes 5 minutes. I just made Isaac do it. Well, actually, Danielle made Isaac do it a couple minutes ago. And I think it's a really good exercise, because as you're learning about these concepts, if you can also then figure out where your opportunities lie. So when I took this quiz the first time, a little over a year ago, the opportunities that I had where I fell the shortest were on the first two of the six principles. It was the seek clarity principle and the generate energy principle. We talked about both of these principles at length last week, but the seek clarity idea is focused and understanding really what priorities are and how you need to develop the skills and create a different environment in your life to be able to achieve those goals. And then the energy concept is more about bringing a consistent level of energy and a positive attitude on a consistent basis. And also there's kind of a framework as far as how to do that from a physical standpoint and also a mental standpoint. And over the last year or so, I've really worked hard at both of those things specifically. That's why I wanted to talk about this, because I think this book has been really helpful for me. I mean, Isaac, what do you think? Are you surprised? Do you think that falls in line? And keep in mind, this is me taking this quiz a year ago.
No, I'm not surprised. I think everybody struggles in all these different dimensions to some extent. They all probably correlate with one another, where a lack of energy, it could be either a manifestation of a lack of clarity or could result in a lack of clarity. It could be the cause or the result. And I think it's not independent levers that one could push and pull in their life. If you work on your sense of clarity or your sense of necessity and your sense of drive, you're going to see energy go up. You're going to see feeling of purpose go up. And you know, if you're low energy and you're exhausted all the time, it's going to be hard to feel clarity.
I agree. And I think as part of that, if I remember some of the questions directly from the quiz, it was more about like having a sense on the energy side. It was having a sense of like high peaks of high energy and then kind of burnout periods. And I think in the mindset that I was in, say, a year and a half ago, I think that we were kind of going up and down these peaks and valleys of working very hard and putting in late nights and early mornings and then hitting a burnout period. And that was kind of eye-opening for me when it translated into, hey, listen, like dial it down a little bit and try to maintain a consistent flow, better habits. You'll be able to have a better lifestyle out of all of this, which will result in a positive outlook, a more positive outlook, which reaps external benefits as well. And I really do think that that was incredibly helpful for me. And these are not things that you can quickly resolve, but in all of these areas, I think that there's always some incremental gains that could be made.
Yeah. So what's the next character dimension that you think was interesting?
Sure. So the next one on the list, so we covered the first three. It was clarity, energy, and then raise necessity, which is something we'll circle back to probably toward the end of this episode. The fourth dimension that Richard writes about in the book is the concept of increased productivity. So generally, this concept of high performers, all of these people are incredibly productive. I think everyone that we surround ourselves with are fairly productive and put in a lot of time. It's not about like hours worked. It's really about the output. And the concept of productivity is really taking the ability to separate the important work from the unimportant work. I think our days they're filled with a lot of unimportant tasks, and we have a desire to make ourselves feel productive, but a lot of these things add up to very little. The book states that close to 28% of working hours is spent responding to emails. And I talk about this concept of emails all the time, is saying that in the grand scheme of things, it really is not something that counts to productivity. You know, Rome was not built on an email thread. The most important things that you will do in your career is probably not something that you're going to make progress to in an individual email. Those things are spent outside, more creative problem solving, things like that. So there's kind of two steps to be able to increase your productivity in your life. The first is better deadline management, and this concept of like keeping necessary deadlines as opposed to preferred deadlines. And this is something that I think we deal with all the time, is when, you know, a client sends us a request, even a prospect will say, hey, look, you know, I want to get a proposal. When can you get me a proposal? And we'll say, I don't know, how's end of next week sound? And we'll just like throw out an arbitrary number or an arbitrary date that's just like far enough in advance with enough cushion. The reality of it is like, I can get that out today. So it's really this idea of holding yourself accountable to better deadlines and actually keeping that actionable. So that's kind of the first thing. Necessary deadlines, not preferred. The second is being more organized with your planning and creating more sub-goals. So again, you know, you can have your to-do list, and that's for short-term things that are pretty tangible. But if you want to achieve something that's much more significant in your life, something that's really significant in your career, chances are you're not going to be able to write that down on a piece of paper and accomplish it by the end of the week. So being able to figure out what are the milestones, what are the sub-goals that I'm going to accomplish along the way. Circling back to last week, I mentioned I use this book as kind of an inspiration for me to write Join or Die. And I think when I look back now and reflect on how I was able to achieve that, part of this idea of sub-goals was something that spoke a lot to me. So I like kind of created these random milestones in my head that I held myself accountable to. I was going to be taking a vacation at some point in March, and I wanted to be able to have the first section of the book completed by then and submitted it to you. Very, very arbitrary, but it was just like, I want to be able to go on vacation and not think about this and take a break. That was step one. Later on, at some point, maybe 3-4 months later, we were going to be delivering a copy of the book as part of a proposal to a large client. And that was another milestone that I had reached toward. So I was able to kind of go in these incremental sprints, but over the course of, say, a year and a half.
I have a question on this, because let's say you break it down to a couple reasons why. You try to segment out potential reasons why somebody doesn't hit a goal that they set. So let's just use your example for a second, right? So you set a goal that you're going to give. You knew you're taking a vacation at a certain date. You knew you're writing a book, which is a massive project. You made a sub goal, which I think is important. It's just an obvious thing. We had a call this morning with a client where like, okay, we have annual projections. They're like, well, we need monthly projections so we could actually see on a smaller temporal basis if we're hitting the goals or if we're tracking towards. And it's true. Like anyone setting goals is like, I want to write a book. Okay, great. Well, why don't you come up with a title? How about you give yourself a week, you know, or you put a goal and you have a title and then you go from there. And then you, okay, I'm going to have an outline, sub-goals. And sub-goals feel good. It's not just a gimmick. It's meaningful to accomplish an intermediary goal. And I would say that it's not just a technique or a mechanism to get you towards the final product. I think a person has to realize that even hitting smaller goals is in and of itself meaningful as far as these character dimensions go. You might not be able to sell a quarter of a book, but you yourself on a personal level, if you're thinking about how to take yourself more seriously and how to organize your life more productively, achieving intermediary sub-goals, even if you never make it to the final product, it is not for naught. It's not a waste. Hitting those milestones has real value as far as your character development goes.
And that goes back to habits. If you make a habit out of working on that ultimate goal in some capacity, whether or not it's the most meaningful or large milestone that you can get, if you ingrain this into your everyday life, all of a sudden that large mountain you're trying to climb becomes much more digestible.
Mm-hmm. There's two things. Remind me if I don't get back to it, like getting yourself back on the wagon, if you've fallen off too many times, it's very depressing. Like setting goals and missing goals and getting into a good routine and then falling out of it, I think it becomes incrementally more difficult to start up again. So that's a separate conversation though, and that's worth talking about. But this one is like, okay, so you set a goal. You told me you're going to have me a version of your manuscript by so-and-so date. Now, there might be two different reasons why you don't hit the goal. One is other things that just take precedence come up. And this is something that I experience all the time, that I set myself goals and deadlines, but then just the day-to-day of competing priorities interfere with my capacity to set that goal. And I tend to be hard on myself saying, like, if I would have worked harder. The other voice in my head says, well, let me look back at the last 3 weeks. I didn't have a second. You know, I saw my own children maybe for a grand total of 45 minutes over the last 20 days. I'm working all day. I could probably find little pockets here and there of inefficiencies. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't be doing this. We should have hired someone to do this. Or, but like all these things pop up. And I was like, this goal that I set for myself, I didn't get done. That's one reason. Another reason is that you just were lazy and you mismanaged your time and you didn't do it. So that's a separate thing. But what about the former? Like, how do you handle that? Because I've had a hard time handling it because it happens all the time and I don't know how to avoid it. I'm setting myself goals and I'm not hitting them because I'm just working round the clock with other things that are of competing importance. And it's hard for me to backtrack and spend the time creating efficiencies in my life and in the business that will allow me to then go hit additional goals. That's very difficult. And I think, I mean, maybe at one point you just have to grow up and do that. Sort of what we spoke about a couple weeks ago, which is like, okay, well, for example, I was spending hours a week getting meetings booked through an online chatbot on my calendar. Those meetings should not be booked on my calendar. There should be a better process in place. But anyway, how do you handle goals that you set for yourself that you can't hit because of competing priorities? Do you, for the sake of the goal, just put that as the ultimate objective? And even if it's going to come at the cost of some other important objectives, do you have a different process?
So that's why all of these habits really fit together. And I think all of this comes back to this concept of self-awareness and really being true to yourself and as far as what matters. But on this topic, the next thing as part of this chapter on productivity is the concept of defining prolific quality outputs, as Burchard refers to as PQOs, which are essentially themes of tangible milestones that you can check off along the way that actually have to do with your long-term goals. And this is something that I've embraced and I start to do on a weekly basis now. So I might have my to-do list that's written out on a piece of scratch paper on my desk of things that I need to, you know, get this thing out. I need to get back to that person. I need to activate this new campaign for a client. That's all like short-term stuff. That's not prolific quality output. That's not something that's like truly meaningful. That's just like essentially busy work that I need to get off my plate. But every single week I sit down and try to figure out where do I want to be at the end of the week in a way that I feel proud about the work that I've done. And if you spend your entire week answering emails and doing busy work, you're never going to feel proud of that. And it's more likely that you're going to be burnt out at the end of the week because it's harder to drive energy on a consistent basis when you're not working towards something meaningful. So it's very important to kind of think about this. But I think part of the problem in our business specifically is that it's really hard to define prolific quality outputs. It's easier, I think, for somebody that's like a blogger, right? Because it's like, okay, well, this week I'm going to publish a blog post. Great. There's like a very, very tangible thing. But when you're an account manager and it's just like, okay, like I have my meetings on my calendar. I have to work on client accounts. I hope things get better. I'm just on this hamster wheel until the sun explodes. You need to work extremely hard at finding what those outputs are. That is part of the reason why we've resulted in burnout over the years, If you're a salesperson and you close a deal, that's very tangible. But when you're an account manager, it's harder if it's just like, okay, we have to meet results, we have to drive performance. And then it's like, okay, well now we have to improve upon those results. So being able to figure that out is extremely difficult. And that's something that I spend a lot of time with our team trying to work on, figuring out what are those milestones that we can work toward.
Yeah, there seems to be like just a huge hesitation around goal setting. I think it runs deep psychologically. It's almost like an admission that you're an adult now. And you don't, when you're finally an adult, you don't want to be an adult. You want to be a kid. My four-year-old last night was like, would not go to sleep. He wanted me to tell him like how old he needs to be an adult. So I was like, I don't know. I just started giving him arbitrary number 15. He's like, well, why 15? I was like, I don't freaking know, dude. Shut the hell up and go to bed. I don't know. I think it runs deep. It's like setting goals and benchmarks. It's like a certain type of uncomfortable like organization and maturity. To some level, it's almost constraints. It's like shackles. You have this, I want to be free and unbound by this whole corporate ideology of goal setting, like something we learned in motivational theory 101. And it's uncomfortable on a personal level. That's probably been part of my struggle with goal setting. Then you sort of start doing it a little bit and you realize that it's fun and it feels good to hit goals.
Well, I think part of the hesitation is like, what if I fail? But the problem with that is you need to set some sort of benchmark. I mean, I'm not saying anything enlightening here that like people haven't heard before. You and I were on a call earlier the day with a client where we set out benchmarks for 2020, and this has been a very crazy year. And those goals, that total return on ad spend revenue number is not going to be met. We were not able to increase conversion rate by the amount that we expected in January of last year. And that's okay. Like, yeah, we missed the mark, but we learned a lot and now we can make adjustments to strategy and now we can factor that into what we're doing next year. And we can be honest about this and transparent. You don't always have to meet those goals as long as you have a good enough reason as to why it didn't happen and what you're going to change about your strategy moving forward to improve upon it. People are so afraid to have that conversation. I don't know if it's affinity toward success or against failure or whatever it is, but I think it's something that everyone needs to become more comfortable with.
See, I have a weird, maybe there's something missing from my brain because I have almost the opposite. I mean, I'm sure you could list a number of things missing from my brain, but I have a weirdly opposite reaction. I can adjust goal setting to be even within the realm of realistic achievement. Like I can't remember the last goal that I set that I hit. Not a single one. You know, they say like, don't order food when you're hungry. Always order too much, but you just never learn. Like you tell yourself that every time you feel sick. And you're now semi-catatonic on the couch. And you'll be like, next time I will only order two mains. I won't order four mains for myself. But you never learn. And I'm going to order four mains the next time if I'm ordering when I'm hungry. Like that's how I have this goal setting thing. I set goals. I never hit them. And then it's like, okay, guys, exciting, Isaac, another goal to set. And I'm like, here's what I'm going to do in the next 4 hours. Right? I'm going to have our website done and I'm going to hire 6 account managers and we're going to move. And that's all going to be done by tomorrow, 9 a.m. And I think at the time I set the goal, I really convinced myself that it's achievable. So I don't know. I eventually, when I say I've never hit a goal, it doesn't mean that I've never accomplished the thing that I set, but I never accomplish it as completely or as well, or certainly not by the time that I think I'll get it done. So I think that the goal setting has at least to some extent been valuable as far as just putting it down on paper. This is what I want to do. And another thing is to track your failures. I use an app called Todoist. And it's like a great little easy to-do list app, reminder app. I like managing a pipeline of leads there more so than in HubSpot because HubSpot's just big and clunky and records and everything. Now I just have, you know, Todoist is like your scratch paper for me. So I have like a weekly things I want to get done in the week and I'll fill it up with the things I think I'll get done in the week. But I mark it as not complete and leave them there. I like to see like, what did I not get done? And I hold myself accountable because then I see the things that are important that are not getting done. It helps me prioritize and say, okay, I need to at least spend some time on that. Another interesting thing with setting goals, you learn what's not so important because you might think that this is really fundamental and this is a really important task. But if you're actually working and you're prioritizing, you have an instinctive way of prioritizing, and you see like 3-4 weeks go by and you haven't gotten this thing done, you realize, you know, maybe that thing is not that important. or you learn that maybe I'm never going to get this done. I got to hire someone else to do it or ask someone else to do it. By setting goals and trusting yourself to prioritize and see how things go, you learn a lot about the things themselves and what's important to you and what's necessary.
I have to be honest. I don't think that's great advice for other people to try and follow, because I happen to know you well enough to know that your ability to do that and be okay with it and make the rational decision about what actually is a priority or not is something that a lot of people don't possess naturally. Also, the idea of setting a bunch of goals and never hitting any of them is, that's also why you have to be the CEO of a company. Ultimately, like, I can't do that because I ultimately have to answer to somebody.
Right. I don't mean that I don't hit my goals. Like I'll give myself too many goals that are unrealistic at once, which is not good. Or I will give myself goals that I'll eventually hit that will take longer than they should take to hit.
So I think what we're getting at here is you understand your own psyche enough to be able to adjust these frameworks in a way that keeps you on track, keeps you motivated, and ultimately is a check and balance system for realizing your long-term goals. I think one of the main takeaways from this book in general is that this isn't a, hey, you should make your bed every morning because people who make their bed are more successful. This is, hey, here's a different way of thinking about goals and habits and tailoring it individually for you. What you outlined that works for you would never work for me. And I think that's fine. And I think that that's important. Ultimately, it just comes back to self-awareness.
I wouldn't underestimate the very simple satisfaction of checking off a task. You might think you're above that. You might think you're so sophisticated, but you're not. It's going to feel good. You're going to enjoy it. You get a bunch of tasks and you get a little check mark. You click it off on a spreadsheet and it goes away. It feels freaking good.
It does. What I will say about that, though, and that's the whole point of the PQO, the prolific quality output, is that you should not have tasks for the sake of having tasks. They should roll up into your primary priorities and goals that'll actually move you forward. It should not be monotonous. I kind of outlined this in a separate message, but because of the fact that I get up and make my lunch and brush my teeth and get dressed and get in the car to go to work, those aren't things that I'm proud to, like, I'm not checking those off a checklist. I'm not going to create this false sense of reality where that's me being productive.
I will rebut that with my own perspective. Sometimes I think it's good and I think it's necessary. Like, sometimes you could elevate the mundane and get yourself reoriented. I don't know. Let's just take washing a car, for example. I don't think washing your car is necessarily a great use of time. It's just a car. If it's really dirty, bring it to the car wash. Like, some people really like washing their car, but not me. If I'm having like a really bad week, or I'm just like not able to orient myself and I'm just down, sometimes I'll bring out the vacuum and I'll clean my car by hand. And it makes me feel really good, even though that's something ordinarily that I wouldn't rate in any way, shape, or form as an accomplishment or something that I should spend my time doing or something that I particularly care about. So I think sometimes if somebody's in a rut, to fabricate a task list, just like you said, even for the sake of checking off tasks, I think it could have a positive emotional, psychological impact where it's wake up at 7, I check that off. Respond to 3 emails, I do it, I check it off. Even things that you do anyway, you could slowly transition up from there, up the scale of importance and meaningfulness as far as your tasks go. You want to continue to aim higher and aim on larger tasks that you might not have otherwise done. But if you're in a rut and you're feeling you want just a place to start and you don't know where to start, make a task list. Think of the things that you do throughout the day. List them off and check them off as you go along, and you'll see how much more time you have. And that will, I think, produce a feeling that you want to increase that load and do even better.
That's fair. I can appreciate that. Let's move on to the next habit. We spent a lot of time covering this concept of productivity here. The next one on the list, number 5, is the idea of developing influence. This is something I'm actually really curious to get your thoughts on. Influence can be defined basically as cultivating the ability to shape others' beliefs and behaviors. So broadly speaking, you develop influence by teaching others how to think and challenging them to grow. So in his journeys, I guess, or whatever, his research for the book, Broussard kind of looked at these list of high performers that he studied, that looked at, And among these trends, of those that were most influential, some of the other characteristics they possessed, they were appreciative, they were giving, they were aware of what others needed to succeed. And I think that kind of goes back and forth. You know, the best leaders, at least in my life, are the ones that do the most listening and lead by example and have a lot of empathy. People that say things like, instead of just giving you direction, they ask you questions. They say, what do you think about this? How about we try thinking about it this way? They're rooting for other people around them to also succeed. And it comes from a genuine place. And then the last part of this concept is that those that have shown to have the most influence are also people who do not hesitate to ask for help when they need it. And I think that's something that really goes both ways in terms of earning empathy and gaining respect and then influence, is being able to admit when you need help.
Okay, I have a lot to say here. It reminded me of a funny story. I remember once, like, I don't know, I was probably 18, 17 or 18, or like, the iPod wasn't really a thing yet, or maybe it was, but none of my friends, none of us had enough money to get an iPod. So like, we were like still going to Best Buy and looking for like the Zune and the Zen and all of those like pieces of crap. But anyway, I went out and got the Creative Zen. So Creative was the brand name. They're not even around anymore, the Zen. So it was like a little portable MP3 player. And I came back, that was like 50 bucks, 60 bucks. And like a bunch of my friends went out and got the Zen. I was like talking it up and I was like showing them, and I was like so enthusiastic about it, like over the top. And then like a few months later, the Microsoft Zune came out, and the Zune was a brick, a literal garden brick that could do nothing other than play music. Apparently it had some internet capability, but like it didn't really. It had a color screen, whatever. And I was like, all my friends who got the Zen, like, got the Zune. I remember thinking to myself, I was like, how far could I take this? Just like keep upgrading, and like everyone's going to go and upgrade. And I don't know if that's not the type of influence we're talking about here, but it leads me to talk about one dimension, and that's enthusiasm, which I think you could also is synonymous with positive energy, because we talk about positive energy a lot when we talk about interviewing candidates. That's very important. Enthusiasm is important because it's infectious. It influences the people around you. If you're enthusiastic about your life, about your work, if you have a general sense of enthusiasm about you, positivity, that doesn't mean you're not self-deprecating. That doesn't mean you don't have bad days. It doesn't mean you can't buckle down and for 6 hours work quietly. But a sense of positive energy and enthusiasm, I think, is vital for this character dimension of influence, because people want to attach themselves to people who feel that life is moving forward. They're enthusiastic about it. I want to be attached to a train that's going somewhere, and that's a happy train. You know, I don't want to be on a slow moving train to hell. I don't want to be part of that bandwagon. But I think the number one most fundamental component of influence is leading by example, which you said it. There's no question in my mind. I've seen this over and over again, and it never fails. It even dawned on me with parenting. Like I used to think, and I think if you ask most people, you say, well, what's the most important thing for a toddler to feel? Like I would have said like that you love them. That you love them unconditionally, or, you know, your love for them is not tied to behavior or whatever it may be. I no longer think that that's the most important thing. I think the most important thing for a toddler to feel is that their parents love each other, or that they're growing up in a loving home, that they see from example that their parents are loving people to other people, to each other, to neighbors. That is more important. And that is what's going to produce the feeling that the child is loved. That's going to produce the character of love within the child. I think that a child will be much better off in a home where, you know, the child might not get as many toys and might not be given as much attention, but he grows up in a house where he feels that there's just a lot of love and respect between his parents, caregivers, or whoever, than if you have constant fighting and tension in a home, but like each parent individually is like showering the kid with love. The former, I think, is a more ideal environment because you're showing by example. In the early days of adventure media, there's no way, it's inconceivable to think that you, Ari, our first round of employees, would have worked as hard as you worked if you saw me working, you know, a few hours a day. I was able to expect and I think influence to some extent a certain work ethic because I was just working. We didn't have seminars on work ethic. I didn't talk to you guys about character. We were just sitting and all working, and we all fed off each other's example of work. And There's no sermon or preacher that could be as impactful as just seeing a leader do the actual work, period. It's inspiring to me. I like this topic because it makes it very achievable. If you want to be someone who is influential, if you want to inspire other people to act, whether it's to work harder or it's to achieve a goal or it's to learn an instrument, you lead by example.
Absolutely. It's a theme that comes up a lot on the topic of influence, whether it's Dale Carnegie's book and Cialdini's written literally a book called Influence. But even like Professor Scott Galloway, the author of The Four, mentions this all the time. Like, the best way to get somebody to listen to you is for them to like you. And the best way to get somebody to like you is to like them first. You know, like to compliment them, to show that you care about them. And they're going to return that favor.
Cialdini, I'll never forget. One of the first examples, now was it Cialdini or was it, it might have been Covey, The Habits of Highly Effective People. I think it might have even been him in his intro.
Okay.
Or Cialdini. But he said that he was struggling. He had a son who was doing very poorly in sports. And he sort of felt that the rest of the team didn't like him and the rest of the team really didn't like him. And like they went to psychologists and they told their son all these different things about how great you are and how much you could achieve and organizing different programs and this and that. And he said, finally, he realized that he himself didn't really believe that his son was capable of achieving. He didn't really believe his son was capable of playing in organized sports effectively. He didn't believe it. And he said that was being communicated to his son, no matter what he did. Like, he could say the words, but children are very perceptive, very. So he writes in his introduction that he started changing his belief construct, his paradigm, and he just felt, he himself taught himself to feel that his own son was capable. And he said that was more impactful, just him believing it. And he writes that it's not really exactly clear how that came across. It was liking a person first and being friendly and being empathetic is the best way to have that reciprocated and the best way to produce influence.
Absolutely. So the sixth habit is demonstrate courage. And this, I think, is really interesting because a lot of people think of the concept of courage as a character trait. It's written in this book as a skill, which is something that can be earned and developed over time, which is completely contrary to what I had always thought on the topic. His research shows that not these three traits are necessary, but of those that demonstrated high courage that he studied, there was a few common themes. The first was they were willing to speak up for themselves and others. They were willing to share truths about themselves, about their desires, their ambitions. And as part of this, they were willing to be vulnerable. The concept of vulnerability is something that I think everyone should look into. Brené Brown has some great literature and TED Talks on vulnerability, and it's something that everyone should try to practice a little bit more. The second is a lot of them, the best way to describe it is honored the struggle, like recognizing that to do great work and to achieve great things, it's very hard and you're going to experience a lot of hardship. And it's not like by honoring the struggle, you're not necessarily complaining, but you're acknowledging it. You're kind of taking it in stride, you're leaning into it. And as part of this, these individuals are willing to get into the weeds and do the hard work that others are not willing to do, the real nitty-gritty work. It really does take courage to step down and to do that. The third thing is a lot of people would identify somebody to fight for. Now, this is something that sort of loosely ties with the raised necessity component, but it's a little bit different. So it's just that idea of like when facing adversity, if we can't draw up the courage to meet that challenge for ourselves, we might be able to do it if we're kind of fighting on behalf of somebody else, whether it's, you know, a loved one, a coworker, whatever. That's something that kind of helps people develop more courage. One of the main takeaways from the final chapter of the book is you want to be able to figure out what is the courageous act that your future self would want you to take. Like if you envision yourself 5-10 years from now being the ideal person that you want to become, and they came back from the future and said, hey, look, get off your ass and do this one very courageous thing. What would that be? And then go and do it.
This is interesting. And this is a topic we could probably talk for the entire next episode about. One, because I think most people struggle with this enormously. Two, I struggle with this enormously. Three, it's a difficult concept to really get to the bottom of. Let's separate it for a second. I think finding someone to fight for is an interesting tactic, but that's easy. It's natural to fight for somebody else. If I see someone downtrodden, being hurt, it's a natural feeling that I want to defend that person and I want to stick up for that person. When that gets difficult is if the person you're sticking up to is someone who you feel their perception of you is important, but then that gets back into your own internal courage. I think it's really hard for people, and I know Ray Dalio talks about this. It's been very hard for me. Most successful CEOs have a very low need for affiliation on the major big five personality scales, because to run a company takes an ability to make a lot of unpopular decisions. You have to get people to do their work. You have to hold people accountable, do things that are just unpopular. I personally have a very high need for affiliation. I want and I need people to like me. And it's been a huge struggle, almost on a daily basis. If it's about giving feedback to an account manager, if it's about having to fire somebody. And that's really been to our detriment. Like, we've had instances where I've let, because of my high need for affiliation and my discomfort with that type of honesty and transparency with myself and with others, you know, our revenue probably has suffered to some extent. Our growth maybe has suffered to some extent. It's an ongoing struggle. And I think part of what my own tactics is along the lines of what you said, is imagining what's in the best interest of my future self, of my future company, of my future family. Like, it hurts now, it's uncomfortable. Think about it. Are you just pushing off the inevitable? Are you pushing off something which is going to be worse if you push it off and be even more uncomfortable? You have to really have this capacity to be honest with yourself. I'll give you an example, a personal example that took place recently. So our director of sales is leaving at Venture Media. He's somebody who you and I are both very close with on a friend level. We're both very close friends with him. He's basically Adventure Media's first employee, or one of the first employees, been with us 6 or 7 years. And him leaving was very painful to hear. It was shocking to me. I didn't see it coming. At the same time, he's moving on to a great position and very proud of him, and so on and so forth. Let's break this down. On one hand, this is where the idea of courage, you need to really be honest with your own emotions. Because my reaction, what I wanted to do was to express, obviously I don't begrudge him. On the other hand, I want to show him how proud I am of him and how excited I am for him to go on to this next step in his career. Now that reaction, while I think that that's appropriate, it could have two separate antecedents. One antecedent could be courage. It could be, I'm going to put down how I feel. I'm going to suppress it a little bit. And I'm going to, for the sake of being more mature and being more of a leader, show him how excited I am. Now, another antecedent of that reaction could be fear. It could be, I don't want to be vulnerable. It's like, I don't want to show that I'm hurt by this. So this is where this concept of courage gets very complex. There could be a right response. The external manifestation of the response could be one thing, which is like, this is what I want to communicate to you, that I'm excited for you and I'm proud of you. On the other hand, it could be a result of two totally separate forces. It could be a result of courage, or it could be a result of fear, the opposite of courage. I think, if I'm trying to be brutally honest with myself, and that's why you need to develop a sense of introspection, is I think I probably was less courageous and more afraid. I think a more authentic response in the moment would have been to tell him how shitty I feel. And I think parenthetically, that would have come across good to him to see that anyway. But I think that I've struggled with this feeling of being vulnerable, and it's always a push and pull. One step further. So he asked me right after he told me in the morning, he's like, I'd like to tell Patrick myself. I'd like to tell Patrick personally that I'm leaving. I've been with Patrick for 6 years. I'm friends with him. And my initial reaction was, well, I should speak to Patrick first. Like, Patrick's the one staying. Why should you go and tell Patrick first? I should get out in front of this and talk to Patrick. That was my initial reaction. What I said to him was, I respect the friendship you have with him, and I will respect your desire to tell him first. Again, I think there's a mixture of courage and fear. I think that the real courageous feeling is, even though I feel nervous and anxious about this, you doing this, like, I respect and I'm willing to, you know, it'll be what it'll be and you do the right thing. On the other hand, there could be like, a fear of being vulnerable, of telling him like, no, I'm nervous. I want to speak to Patrick first. It's like, you're making yourself vulnerable and look weak a little bit. There's a mixture. It's a combination of different forces within a person. But just in general, like being transparent, telling a person how you really feel, it's so difficult, you know? Ray Dalio talks about this a lot. It's very hard. I've seen this with every employee I've had. I've seen it with you, like having conversations where I catch myself like not really saying exactly how I feel because I don't want to be unliked, or I don't want to say something that's you're going to argue with, or I don't want to say something that you don't want to hear. I don't do it all the time. I think as everyone will say, I probably say quite a bit that no one wants to hear, but it's difficult. It's really difficult, especially if people with a high need for affiliation, which is probably most people who have a high need for affiliation. And all I could say is this. I've never had a situation. By the way, everything here is always except for marriage. Obviously, it's always an exception. Okay, so when I say I've never had a situation where I've said how I really feel and it blew back, that means except for marriage. Okay, so you don't say how you really feel when you're married. But in business and in life, I've never had a situation where I've erred on the side of transparency and calmly stated how I really feel about something to a person who's mature and intelligent and we're in the same boat and want growth and who's respectful. Had that been, you know, really negative. I've only had situations where I harbored how I felt. I didn't communicate how I felt. And it ends up just either causing internal agitation or causing agitation with whoever I'm speaking to who sort of picks up that I'm not being transparent or not being authentic. So yeah, I think there's a lot on that. And I think courage is a really interesting one. Like you said, I never thought of it as a skill either. I always thought of it as a trait, but I think you probably could think of it, about it as a skill, something that you could work on and improve. But it is a tough one. It is a tough one because it really gets to the core of judgment and people and you sort of trying to maintain your sense of status in society and in your relationships. And it takes courage to say and do things that in the moment feel like you're threatening your societal well-being and threatening the status of your relationships.
I completely agree. All of these things working together is, I think it's really important to see like, okay, well, if I were to factor all of these different habits into my life and see where I lacked, you know, maybe there's some individual things that make sense to me or don't really align with what I think is achievable over the long term. Really important here is being able to look at those opportunities and say, okay, well, you know, I don't think I generate consistent energy on a consistent basis and I need to work on that. Or I feel that as a leader, I am not taking enough courageous acts and being as vulnerable as I should be at times and being as transparent as I should be with my team. And I think that if I do so, not only will it allow me to develop more courage, but it'll also help me develop a little more influence and become a little more likable and all those other things. So all these things kind of tie together. And I think just overall, the main theme here is that the introspection, to borrow a word that you used a minute ago, is what this entire process is all about. And it's being brutally self-aware and vulnerable, I guess is the recurring theme, to be able to figure out how you can improve, you know, multiple elements of your life, whether it's the individual work that you put out, the relationships that you develop over your life. And I think it's really great. And I think that, you know, as I said at the beginning here, this book was incredibly meaningful to me. It helped me in a lot of ways. I mean, it guided me toward accomplishing a big goal over the last year, but also in bring more positivity and energy and a lot of other important tactics that I've now carried into my daily life. We have some other thoughts on this as well. I think that there'll probably be topics for future episodes. We've kind of built upon these principles that were outlined in the book, High Performance Habits. I think that we'll be excited to dig into our own take on a few other habits we would add to this list. But for now, I think that's it.
Very good stuff. I, for one, enjoyed talking about this, as I'm sure you knew that I would. You've been listening to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. Make sure you pick up a copy of Join or Die, Digital Advertising, the Age of Automation on Amazon. Check us out online at adventurepbc.com. And we look forward to the next episode, and we look forward to you joining us. Cheers for now.